Welcome back to part two with special guest Kate Davies, picking up where we left off discussing the housing shortage in Britain.
And we would say that between us, or wouldn't we? But the simple fact is we just haven't got enough housing in Britain.
Correct.
And that's why everybody who ever does the study says we need 300,000 houses per annum being built over the next 20 years, at 6 million new homes to house all of our needs. And the fact is we're just undersupplying a short market. I mean, this year, I think people are sort of forecasting something like 150,000 homes. It's half of the need for this year alone. And the last time we built 300,000 houses in any one year, I think, was in 1974, which is frightening, isn't it?
A long time ago.
Yeah. And despite the best will in the world, and Labour have said that as soon as they get into power, if they get into power, they want to build 300,000 homes per annum in each of the years of the first parliament. It's just not going to happen. I mean, they're saying that's going to come from building on brownfields, as if there's we haven't built on a lot of those already, and by building new towns. Now, when Richard and I were at Countryside, we built a lot of new, large, strategic communities from sort of 1,000 to 4,000 homes. They took typically somewhere between 7 and 25 years to get off the ground. So I can't see how they're going to contribute to year one of a new administration.
Well, I don't think they will, but at least they've got an ambition,
yeah,
you know,
and
a
nothing,
bit of a vision at the moment. So let's hope that does survive. But you do need to plan longer term than your average parliament, don't you?
Absolutely.
Personally, I think the idea of new towns is a good idea. I mean, this is very different from the idea of ship out the poor, but we do need some new dwellings, you know, and we do need some new settlements. The green agenda could be interesting. Could we create communities where net zero is built into the whole fabric of it? Another idea would be, let's build some communities based around the needs of women and children, for example. I mean, it's a very different idea from the usual idea. Could we build communities where everybody works, where, you know, even people who are elderly or disabled or whatever, everybody can engage in making that community work? I mean, new ideas.
Or more emphasis on trading with each other.
Exactly.
And how far do you think this should all be influenced through the planning yeah. process? I mean, I think, you know, we talked earlier about the difficulty the country is in terms of, you know, lack of government money, frankly, whether it's in the NHS or housing or whatever it is. And until growth, economic growth gets back, there's not going to be a lot of handout from the government. But it just seems to me that planning could be used much more effectively. So, you know, when planning consent's given for a piece of land, its value rockets up to millions of pounds per acre. If some of that land value is used to subsidise affordable housing, more so than that occurs today. I mean, you know, every borough district around the country will have to provide a certain amount of housing through planning agreements. But I think that the planning system could go a lot further. And I think a lot of landowners would happily release their land for a fraction of what they would get if it was all released for private housing. So for me, the planning system could play, while the country's struggling, I think the planning system could create its own sort of subsidy to really get more affordable housing delivered. But it's got to happen quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a great idea. And I think there are a lot of potentially clever ideas to do more with not much more resources. It's just a sort of sometimes how you use it and how you bring people together. Most of government is kind of divided into, you know, structures that don't work together at all. The people dealing with housing and communities are a million miles away from health or a million miles away from defence, you know, and the Treasury. They're all highly segregated and fight in their own corner. If you had a strategy for the country as a whole, and we saw in the immediate post-war period there was an idea of let's maximise housing numbers to get the country back on its feet, to get people living in somewhere decent, to, you know, bring the country into the modern era, it happened. Yeah, it happened because the government as a whole was focused on that. I mean, I haven't met in my lifetime top politicians who really believe that housing is vital in the way that we do. They just don't have that passion for it or that direction. It's always the sort of, well, somebody who attends cabinet, you know, they don't put their very best people.
Do you think the Labour Party, who, let's face it, are likely to be the next government, do you think they really mean it? Do you think they really will set about delivering housing? I mean, I think they see it as a the potential to revive growth. I think they see a housing-led economic recovery being a strong part of their strategy, and I think they see it as a vote winner, whereas the Tories see it as a vote loser.
Yes.
Do you think they really believe in it?
I think they probably do, but they've been keeping their cards very close to the chest. And I think this is a time for innovation and collaboration across sectors, getting the private sector, the social landlords, the councils and the planning departments, the investors, the government funders, all of them together to say, look, we've made a bit of a pig's ear of this. Shall we go back to basics and say, what can we do? What can we do with existing stock? What can we do with government land? What can we do with new town ideas? You know, is there foreign investment to bring in? You know, okay, we're not in the EU anymore, but theoretically that gives us an opportunity to do things differently. What about a sort of bond that the public can support? You know, I mean, I don't know. Just start doing some proper blue sky thinking, because we are in a jam. Mm. We're in a bad place.
And I think the government also needs to, but in the current government, I don't think does, really understand the benefit of the house building industry
as an infrastructure.
So the widest part of the economy. I mean, you know, our industry, if we could build 300,000 houses a year, but let's just say it's what it is now, employs a huge amount of people in our offices and on sites. But of course, we're bringing whole massive materials together. So we're creating employment in all of those factories. Everybody who buys a new home typically, or housing, typically then buys new things for it, carpets, curtains and all sorts. So the wider impact on the economy is huge. And let's face it, if you're in a world of rising house prices, and even if they're rising modestly, it gives you a warm glow. You feel a lot better than when they're going the other direction, where everybody pulls their horns in. So it's a really important part of the economic drive in the country. And I don't think the Tories just don't get that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems as if they've just listened to the sort of far-right element. They've listened to people, home counties,
NIMBYs,
who, as I said earlier, are almost certainly going to vote Tory anyway, thinking that if they sort of allow a lot of new housing, it's going to be a vote-losing issue. I mean, personally, I think they're going to get a complete panning in the election, and I think all of the have-nots, the silent majority, who will vote, most of them will vote, I think they'll be out and they're going to get an absolute panning. But, you know, it's exciting, isn't it? There's likely to be a new way.
It's fascinating, isn't it, Richard? I remember our late father telling us when we were younger that in the 50s and 60s, the government who promised the most housing would get into power, because obviously after the war there was so much destruction and rebuilding that had to be done. Whereas today, I wouldn't say it's the party that's offering the least new housing, but it's interesting how it's switched so much when the country is so desperate for more housing.
And I think it's leadership also, isn't it? It's that, you know, you can sort of listen to what people are saying and then do what you think they want. There's another way, isn't there? There's leadership. What should you do for the country as a whole that will be good for the country over the decades ahead? Yes. We're just not having enough of that.
I totally agree. I mean, that is what leadership is, and it's sort of putting your head above the parapet. I mean, you talked about the NIMBY factor. I mean, I even know some people in social housing, I'm sorry to say, who've objected to planning in their local area. And in the building industry, I've also met quite a lot of people who don't really like social housing. I mean, I know present company accepted, because you absolutely get the need for the mixed and balanced communities. But, you know, even people involved in the industry don't see it as a good thing that there's lots of affordable housing. I mean, what's not to like about affordable housing, giving people somewhere to live that they can afford? You know, the number of young people who are forced into the private rented sector at the moment, the number of young people who are living at home until they're quite old, can't, you know, some people in my own family are worried about don't feel they're able to have a baby yet because their mortgage is so big compared to their salaries. You know, this is impacting massively on lots of people. In fact, apart from older people who've paid off the mortgage, everybody's in the fix, you know.
And how often do we go to dinner parties where somebody around the table says, do you know what, there's a proposal to build 50 homes in our village, we must fight this to the death, blah, blah, blah. And about half an hour later, they say, do you know what, our young son, he's got to go and live in Diss in Norfolk. Sorry, Diss, but, you know, it's the distance I'm making. It's absolutely appalling he can't live locally. I say, do you not those think those two things may be reflection of one and the other? Oh, you would say it was a greedy house builder. I mean, honestly, talk about short-sightedness.
But one of the problems, I suppose, is that we all complain about politicians. And are we any of us prepared to get involved? Have you ever thought about that, Kate? Would you see yourself?
I mean, I feel I'm a one person campaign sometimes. You know, trying to raise ideas that I think are right. If politicians and local authorities and planning authorities and housing associations, anyone, took the time to sort of explain to people how things work, give them a more sophisticated understanding of any issue, they usually are able to make very sensible decisions. But we sort of keep politics across to a very small number of people and they decide how to do it. But I think there's a case for much more democracy in this country where people learn about something, whether it's European Union or about the age for voting or gender issues, whatever it is, you know, just explain to people.
Since you've stepped down from your role as chief exec at Nottingham Genesis, I know you've sort of sought to influence more from arm's length, and you recently produced a very interesting white paper. I think that's to influence, to provide sort of strategic influence in the affordable housing sector. But can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, what sort of lay behind that? What are the key themes? Where are you trying to drive people?
So for me, when I did my job, it was very, very fascinating job, but it was also relentless. You know, the problems we were dealing with were big and daily, you know, you had to pay attention to the daily problems. So I can't say I spent an awful lot of time in reflecting. So for me, when I gave up that big job, I went to Spain to learn Spanish, which is something I've had an ambition for some time, but it wasn't all day, every day. So I just had some time to think and reflect. And I was thinking, you know, what would I have done differently? If I was starting today, would I have a different agenda? So that's where my idea of the pamphlet, the white paper, came from. And I thought, I'm not going to emphasise this thing we've more been talking about, which is growth and building more homes, because I think that's been very well made. It was more like, what do we do with the existing stock? And I felt that it is being neglected, and that impacts on people's living conditions. And you only have to see the television programmes about damp and mould or whatever. And of course, the great tragedies we had of the Grenfell fire and the death in Rochdale of a young boy from damp and mould. You know, when you're having people dying because they're living in social housing, it's pretty shocking and upsetting. And it makes people think. It makes people in government think. And some of the things they've done in response to those are not bad things, but I feel we need to go upstream a bit more and work out, why is there this a problem? It's not that bad people are living in social housing. It's not that bad people are running social housing. It's that the policies aren't right for the problem. And that's really what I was trying to address. Like, with different policies, we could actually get this right.
Can you give us a couple of examples, just to sort of drill into a bit? So when you say policies aren't right, I mean, what might be one or two examples of a bad policy and how we could improve on that?
Well, one example is there's a lot of pressure now to say that if a housing association doesn't do an emergency repair in 24 hours, they're breaking the law. Is that the way to fix it? I mean, why are some repairs not being done in 24 hours? I mean, there's quite a lot of reasons why. One might be that you can't fix it in 24 hours. It's too complicated a problem. It's too big a problem. It's too deep-seated a problem. Damp and mould is not just a matter of papering over the cracks or washing it down. Sometimes it can be quite a fundamental problem with the house. So you probably couldn't fix that in 24 hours. There are others where you can't necessarily get access. You can't necessarily get the contractor out. The contractor can't park because there's nowhere to park. Various things happen. I mean, to me, of course, everybody has a target of 4 hours for an emergency repair, never mind 24. You're always trying to get it done immediately. If water's spewing out or you've got live electricity in the walls, it's like immediate, yeah, it has to be done. But no one wants to do them slowly. But in reality, is it sensible to say you break the law if you don't do that? I mean, there are other ways to manage people's behaviour. I don't think fining landlords is a great idea, because they're short of money anyway. Some people say, well, sack the lot of them. You know, I've heard that. And it's easy to say. And people think that housing associations are run by idiots. And they're not. They're people working as hard as they can in very difficult circumstances. They're no better or worse than anybody you employ or anybody who's listening today employs. They're good, intelligent people with their heart in the right place, working pretty long hours to make it work. So it isn't as simple as sack them all or set a strong target. Loads of targets. Why are some repairs taking a long time to do? My argument is one in four social homes is not fit. It's a pretty big problem, isn't it? You know, you can't fix that with a regulation. You've got to say, how are we going to fix this stuff?
Well, probably all of us involved in new housing, whether it's house builders, house associations and investors, we've all had quite a lot of bad press in recent years. Some of it has been very justified. Mm-hmm. I think what we're very bad at is selling out telling people about the success stories. Mm. And obviously recently those, you know, the fire, the awful Grenfell situation, all the mold stories and so on are very bad. Mm. But, you know, out of the sector, mm, out of the people involved, I think we should together do a lot more to talk about the success of new housing. I mean, you look at some of the awful estates, historic estates that have been regenerated, and they've made a fantastic difference to people's lives. And if you go onto those estates, or the newly regenerated estates, and you talk to people who lived in terrible conditions for decades and decades, and how it's made such a difference on their lives, and you just walk around these communities, they're safe, healthy, lovely. I think the stats reveal that the individual health of people living there has improved dramatically. I think we should do a lot more to tell that story. We tend to tell it to each other within the housing world, don't we? We don't do a lot to tell that to the wider public.
I don't know.
I think we could do a lot more.
I don't really agree with you on this one, Richard, because I think there's a lot of self-congratulation in the industry. And there's good stories, for sure. I mean, the fact that a new build home can be cost nothing to heat because it's so well insulated is a very good example to me. You know, that's something only new build can do. But, you know, I think that we should move away from self-congratulation and we should be moving towards, you know, what could we do better? You know, let's have a culture of improvement. Let's have a self-critical reflection. I'm not necessarily talking about Stone Bond or Notting Hill Genesis in particular, but a way we're doing things at the moment isn't the best way. It's not the most efficient way. It's not best. You know, you want to have a policy that meets the need of business, meets the need of poor people, meets the need of the environment, meets the need of children. You know, that we want to try and tick every box. The country is divided by people polarizing into different positions. And we need policies which actually benefit the community as a whole. So everybody gets a fair share. That's my personal.
I mean, obviously, you know, we all love compliments. We like our egos being stroked. But I was really talking about the influence, which, you know, if the wider public thought of new housing and the way new housing is managed as being a predominantly good thing, if they could influence government more and really help drive good things. I just think that it could help us all. So it's not so much, you know, being congratulated. It's more, how can we influence the country to get behind new housing and the good that it does for us all?
We have to just do it better.
I mean, you moving away a little bit from the actual providing new homes and managing homes and so on. I mean, you led an organisation for, I think, 18 years in Notting Hill Genesis. Managed over 60,000 homes. So a huge organisation with all the logistical challenges and, you know, huge team, thousands of people you were managing. What was your culture and approach to that, and how did you get there?
Yeah, I think culture is really, really important, isn't it? You've got to have a clear strategy, and I would describe Stonebond having a clear strategic thrust. As soon as I became a board member, I could read what you stood for, and it was very clear. So good, clear strategy, and then a good culture where everybody's pulling in the same direction. And the strategy helps create the culture, but the culture delivers the strategy. So I think organisations, big and small, the thing is you have to have people who want to work there, who get pleasure out of meeting the targets and delivering the objectives. that you don't try and do too much. You know, you focus on what you're good at and you get better and better at it, and people get rewarded with promotion or pay rises or whatever, so that they're invested in the company. You know, that was pretty rare.
And they feel valued.
They do.
That's the number one.
Yeah. That's the magical ingredient. And I've, you know, since I've left Notting Hill, I've been working with a few investors. And the key thing I would look for in a firm that's going to be successful is the quality of the management and the culture that they've created. You know,
looking back, just in terms of the highs and lows, what would be a couple of things that I know you're quite a modest person. What are a couple of things you think were the things you feel most pleased about that gave you most satisfaction? And then what are a couple of things that you, in hindsight, you would have done differently?
I think the thing I'm proudest of is the culture and the people I developed. I mean, I took some particularly very young women, and same with some black people from ethnic minority backgrounds, and supported them so they could get to the top. And I did that personally as well as organisationally. And I'm really, really proud of the leadership that's still there and performing very, very highly. If you take someone who's in their 20s and they're running a £100 million turnover business, say, you know, they soon learn how to do it well, and they really performed. And I think a clear, what you might call a culture of performance, not very pernickety little things, but everybody had their own bottom line. Everybody had to deliver some profit. Everybody had to contribute. So I would say culture and strategy are things that I probably did quite well. I suppose for me, I feel that asset management and repairs services never really got to the level that I would expect it or want it for myself. And the other is, I don't think we harness new technology in a very creative way. We started, and I think Notting Hill's far in advance of many, but the sector's trying to do it one by one. Everyone's wasting their money and their time on trying to design the technological fix, whereas actually, if everybody worked together, there is some basic, simple technology available today to raise the game, because we haven't got unlimited money. What can you do with what you've got? You can certainly understand your stock a lot better. I think there's a huge amount of waste because people order day-to-day repairs when actually they need to fix the fabric of the building, and that could just save loads of money. But it needs to be technically driven with data, not just individuals sort of making up their mind, which is sort of what happens. So I would say the property side needs to really raise its game, and technology is the means to an end. So I hope the people who've come after me get that and bring it forward.
Moving the discussion on a bit, Kate, I mean, obviously today, in today's environment, a lot of housing is built by working in partnership between the house builders and the housing associations. And over the years you were in charge at Notting Hill Genesis, you would have done quite a lot of joint ventures or working in partnership with them. Developers. I mean, how did you perceive the house builders, and what would you typically be looking for in your ideal partner?
That's a fascinating question, because, you know, I started my job in the 1980s, and the sites I used to go and see had nude calendars and, you know, dirty toilets where you say, where's the women's toilet? There wasn't one. You can go in the men's if you're desperate, but you wouldn't. That compared to today, when you go around a site today, it's spotless. There are women on site wearing hard hats just like everybody else. The health and safety is such an issue that never was before. The attention to detail is much, much sharper. Certainly when I started out, we were basically buying from big house builders under Section 106. Here you are. Do you want these 20 units, two-bed flats in blah, next to the railway? That's what we're offering, and we want this kind of amount of money. Not very attractive proposition. You don't really know what you're getting. It isn't necessarily right for the people who are waiting for the housing, compared to the partnership approach and the close relationship that I had with your predecessor organisation. And, you know, I see Stone Bond doing today for real, is a close relationship that starts before anything is even designed or built. It starts with land in the right place or not the right place. You know, that is the discussion you're having with a housing association. Is this a good place to build homes? What sort of homes should we be building? What are you interested in? What do you aspire to? Do you want four beds or do you want flats? Do you want bungalows? You know, it's a partnership. And usually it also involves the local authority. So, you know, what the planning is going to produce from there as well is part of the discussion. And that is fundamentally different. Those people who came and said, buy my section 106 would be blokes who wore ties and short sleeve shirts. They lived in the home counties. They did not know how to talk to housing association people. They were deeply patronising and, you know, sort of take it or leave it. Whereas today, the sort of people you employ are exactly the kind of people that I can talk to. I can share my requirements and also my issues and difficulties and problems, and I can get a proper response from people who understand what it's like. They're not patronising at all. They go out of the way to try and meet what the housing association is trying to achieve, and it's very refreshing. But it also makes sense, because with a customer that you're selling to know what they want and what they're trying to achieve is the first rule of selling. Yeah,
I think that long-term partnerships is really key, isn't it?
I think
we'd like to think that. I mean, I think the very best mixed tenure housing we've delivered has been as a result of long-term partnerships. And you don't get things right all the time, do you? I mean, it's like, I suppose, a marriage. You have to work at it. You get things wrong occasionally. But I think if you're really motivated to have a good relationship and, you know, really get two and two making three and really working on how you can add value and working to your strengths. I mean, I think as a house builder working with a really good housing association, I think the skill fit's very good. We know we bring different things to the table, but you've got to work at it. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, you know, been our mantra for many years, and you know that's how what we're looking to do for the future.
Yes,
and as you know, we've been through our whole of our development processes in recent times, looking at all of the touch points we have with our partners to try and really get under their skin, not in the irritating way, but to understand what they want to adapt our business to be able to become, as I keep saying, the first partner of choice. We want our partners to think of us before anybody else.
But Kate, it's been a really fantastic session today. Thank you very much for your time. We feel very privileged to have you on our board.
Oh, and privilege is all mine.
Really enjoy working with you, and you're very candid in your thoughts. And I'm sure any listener to this session will be very interested. So many thanks.
Well, thank you.
Which is gracias.
De nada.